Think about the last time you had to cancel a subscription. There's probably some waiting on hold, some guessing at your password, some mind-numbing small talk, and maybe after all that, you still weren't able to cancel it. Good news, it doesn't have to be this way. Thanks to Rocket Money. Rocket Money tracks, manages, and can cancel your subscriptions for you. When you connect your accounts, you'll see a complete picture of all your recurring subscriptions all in one place. Rocket Money organizes your subscriptions by due date and notifies you when something's coming up, so you'll never be caught off guard when you get charged. If you see a subscription you want to cancel, Rocket Money simplifies the process. Instead of waiting on hold for an hour, you can cancel it right from the app. Rocket Money will even try to get you a refund for the money you spent on subscriptions you forgot about. Stop wasting your time trying to cancel subscriptions the hard way. Make your life easier and go to rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. Or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play Stores.
Aina, do you know what the best feeling in the world is?
Ooh, is it, you know, when you finally beat a boss after messing up loads of times?
I mean, that's a good one.
Or actually, you know when you unlock a new skin in a game without having to buy it?
Yeah, solid.
Yeah, that's good. Oh, actually, what about when you blue shell someone last second and then you win the race?
I mean, they are all good options.
Well, it's not one of them.
It's not one of them. They're good options. But I think it's when you've got your new game loaded up, you are ready to go, you're getting locked in, but you've got a chocolatey friend.
Hey, hey! Now we're talking,
absolutely,
bro.
They are there, ready to give you a little power up, a little energy boost before you get going.
Especially if it's a lovely milk chocolate slab between two crisp biscuits.
You know the one, Ainel. It makes the world's most satisfying snap when you bite into it. It's got to be a pick-upper.
Pick-up! Oh, yeah! Oh, are you going for the OG pickup? You know the one with the blue box?
Yeah, this blue box.
That blue box?
Yeah, this is really good. I mean, I'm also dabbling with the salted caramel as well.
Okay.
There are loads of different flavours out there. Whichever one you go for, there is no better snack for when you're getting ready to get into a big gameplay session, about to pick up your controller and get into it.
Yeah, and they're super easy to eat as well. No chocolatey fingers over the controllers. Nah-uh. And that's thanks to the two crisp biscuits hugging the chocolatey slab.
Nobody wants chocolate marks on their controllers, do they? Absolutely not. You can find out more by just searching for Pick Up on your phone.
Pick Up and Go.
So I guess the obvious place to start, Abo, is just sort of, if someone has stumbled upon this who is not necessarily as across your work as maybe other people are, how do you, when at parties, how do you describe yourself? You know, when you meet someone, you're like, oh, hey, I'm Abo. Because it's so many, I was just looking at, you know, obviously, you know, do our research here, Abo, do you know what I mean? We're serious.
Wow,
this is
really?
A serious thing, you know. Well, we've looked in.
I thought we'd just
like, where do you start? Yeah. Where do you start when you describe what you do?
I think, you know, funnily enough, if someone was to ask me at a party what I do, I normally just say like I'm a builder, or like I'm a, you know, I just, you know,
just
kind
you duck
of
it.
My thing. Yeah, I kind of duck it because it's so complicated. Like, I mean, I'm still trying to figure it out, right? Because you kind of sound a bit like you sound a bit like an idiot if you go around saying, oh, I tell stories. Yeah. Do you know what I mean?
I'm a storyteller.
Because then they're like, yeah, so do I when I'm putting my daughter to bed. What are you chatting about?
Yeah,
do you know
yeah.
what I mean?
So, hey, look, I can read the Gruffalo like everybody else, mate, all right?
Exactly.
You know what I mean?
This is the thing. So, like, I think the way that I think, so, all right. If I was to explain to someone, what do? I think I'd start by saying I'm an actor. So I'd say, yeah, I'm an actor. And normally afterwards they're like, I've not seen you in anything. And they're like, you'd normally think of EastEnders or like Hollyoaks or whatever. And then you say House of the Dragon. They're like, oh, I didn't watch that. Game of Thrones was terrible the way it ended. And you're like, great. So
cheers, mate. Thank you.
Yeah,
thank
cheers,
you.
Thank you.
Yeah, yeah.
So I'd start with an actor because I think like for me, that's a lot easier to kind of grasp. And then I'd tell them essentially, oh yeah, you know, I'm an actor, I do, you know, film, TV, theater, but also do video games. I've done video game, you know, acting as well. And then as we kind of see where they are thinking like, oh, games, that's really interesting, get their kind of knowledge on it. And then I'll be like, oh, I also make games as well. You know, I'm a game developer because I love games and I love kind of, you know, telling stories in that format as well. But I do also, you know, every now and then write, I do, you know, direct. But yeah, essentially, you know, and then I will say, yeah, I just enjoy telling stories.
Yeah.
That's normally how
you get to it. I'm going to get to it. I'm going to drop the line. It's cheesy, but it's true.
But it works when you know the context. So yeah, so that's essentially how I'd go about it, mate.
Yeah, in context, it makes sense. Out of context, it sounds odd. Yeah,
it sounds terrible. Yeah, it really does. It sounds really, really wanky.
Well, look, for the purpose of this, because there's so many things, there's so many... first of all, we're so chuffed that you're on the podcast. We love looking at like games from different perspectives and chatting to people who make them come to life. So we're loving having you on. But there are so many things we can go after. So I guess we will try and split those, I suppose, apart so we can sort of grasp it in our heads. So I suppose let's start with the acting stuff then. When did you know, you know what, I think I do want to tell stories for a living. Yeah. You know, when did you know you wanted to be an actor?
So I'd say that the moment in which really sort of I decided like this is for me, or this is what I want to do. I had auditioned for something called the National Youth Theatre, which is essentially like, it's like a charity for kids, but you know, here in London, here in England, in regards to like theatre and acting and all that malarkey.
Yeah.
But you have to audition to get in, and then you go through this course. And then once you're part of this course, you're part of the NYT alumni, and then you get like, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
But like, I remember, so doing it at school, I only enjoyed doing it at school because it was like the only thing I enjoyed and I was good at. Like, I liked the English, math, science, whatever. But to be honest with you, I was more so there to be with my mates and have a laugh, like very much a class clown, because I wasn't very good at that stuff. But like, I enjoyed drama. I enjoyed the idea of acting, the idea of performing, the idea of like kind of, you know, being different people. And I'd say truly, like, it was the National Youth Theatre and kind of being told or taught that, like, there's more to just performing than just, you know, kind of being a bit silly. It's actually about moving people. It's about, like, kind of telling really cool stories and showing humanity. And, like, again, I'm like a kid, right? So I'm not, like, necessarily taking this in fully, but there is something about what was being told to me that really resonated with me. And I think that was really cool, like the idea of being able to communicate and connect with people through performing and telling these stories. So that, I think, was where the real love for acting kind of kicked in. And I'd say, like, as I've, you know, gone on and kind of been in this industry now, it just continues to grow and continues to evolve, because I think like it was very much something that I discovered by myself rather than necessarily something that was like in the family. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But yeah.
And you're experiencing, you're at the theatre and you're sort of seeing what this world can give you. That is a jump between doing something you enjoy though and figuring out, oh, actually, this is something that could make me some cash. Do you know what I mean? This is more than just fun. This is like,
this could be a living. But, but you know what the thing is, again, it's that whole thing of, I remember very, very early on saying like, I will never like waste my time or do something that I don't want to, like, don't like doing. So I'm not going to do a job that I don't like doing. And I know like some people have to, and you know, and you know, sometimes you have to, and I've done it. Obviously you can't avoid it sometimes, but like, I just remember saying, like, having this really stubborn mentality of like, if I'm ever going to have a job or make money or do something, I'm going to want to enjoy it and have fun in it. And so, you know, I kind of pride myself in this, knowing that like, ever since, you know, I've never had like a job in like a John Lewis or like a Marks and Spencer's or like a coffee shop or even a pub. I've always acted. And like, that's just been because, you know, either I've been looking online for like casting things, or like, you know, trying to, you know, help mates do like short films or, you know, whatever, even if it's like a few bits of cash here and there. Like, you know, even with NYT, I remember they had this old sort of program where essentially you could like put yourself up for auditions, and I put myself up for like everything because I was like, I want to
spamming it.
Yeah, literally, I was like, I just want to do this. And you know, that's been essentially my source of income from the get-go. And even when it came to even, you know, now making games, it's like I've always been of the mentality of like, nah, if I'm gonna work towards something, I have to enjoy it, because I feel like life's too short, man.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
You must be good with, and please take this the way in the spirit in which the question was intended. You must be good dealing with rejection then, right? Because everyone, oh, yeah. And it's same as my industry, you're like, you go for stuff, you get less than 10% of the things you're in conversations for, the meetings you have. And if you're putting yourself for all those auditions, obviously you didn't get all of them, but you're cool to be able to be like, okay, fine, it's not for me.
I think because it's that whole thing of like, the way I see it, it's about telling the story in the right way. And most of the decision makers or like the people who are telling these stories, they have a vision in mind. And so you've got to kind of respect that. Like it's not, you know, a lot of the time, it isn't actually to do with any of your skill or your talent. It's to do with just how they envisioned this being depicted. And it might be right or it might be wrong, but ultimately they're the ones driving the car, right? It's the same way in which like, you know, you're being in the back of a taxi and the guy, you know your way home, but this guy is deciding to take a different route and you're like, I wouldn't really take that route. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, it's up to you. So
it's up to you.
You've gone left there, have you? Okay, fine.
Exactly. And I think like, that's really the way in which I sort of see the rejection element. Like it is just someone deciding to go down a different path. Now, ultimately, you know, there are elements that you can obviously do to better yourself, to get yourself a better chance at stuff. But I do feel like a lot of the time it is beyond your control. And once you've accepted that, you can just kind of take it. It's not really, I think when people say you have to have thick skin as an actor, I think a lot of the time that is really, you're kind of talking to the ego there. And you shouldn't really be talking to the ego. You shouldn't really see rejection as a rejection against you. It's more so a rejection of the idea of what the world you are envisaging and what it should be. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, I've had this conversation with a lot of young journalists or presenters who ask for advice. And I said, often if you don't get a job, it's not necessarily about you. And you've got to take yourself out of it, isn't it? It's not about you necessarily or about how good you are. Because often you'll see the person that gets a job like, okay, cool, they went that way, did they? Okay, fine. Do you know what I mean? And you, like you say, you're not driving the car, so it's up to the other person. But it is tough, though. It takes a bit of getting used to for people. You know?
It does. And I think like that, and I can remember as well, like going up for some big auditions, like big life-changing auditions. And, you know, in my head thinking, this is it. This is my moment. And then it not going my way and kind of being like, oh, does that mean I'm never going to act again? Or like it's never going to happen again? But then, you know, I think life has a very interesting way of sort of just telling you to carry on. You know what I mean? Like, a big moment, actually. There's two big moments. I'd say the first big moment that made me realize, like, essentially, you just have to keep calm and carry on. It was after my dad died. And that sort of reality check of like, okay, he died when I was like 20. You know, just before I turned 21, and 21 was supposed to be like the really cool big age. I had this idea of like parties and, you know, having everyone that I love around and all this sort of stuff. And I had this vision of, you know, my dad's going to see me like get married, have kids, yada, yada, yada. He's going to see my kids because he's a great, you know, he loves kids, all that kind of stuff. And then he died and that kind of almost shifted and changed everything. It didn't go my way. And I think like that was a big moment of like realizing, oh, okay, maybe I'm not in control of as much as I think I am. And then the other moment was, funnily enough, quite recently with Raised by Wolves and the series being canceled. You know, this was like a big Ridley Scott show. It was crazy sci-fi. It was wacky. It was out there. It was fun. It was good. People enjoyed it. And then suddenly series three got canceled and pulled and the whole show just, you know, kind of disappeared. And that was a moment where I was like, oh man, you really just have no idea, or like no one was expecting that to happen. So it was just like a moment of like, great, I have no control over a lot of these factors. And so really, those are hard moments. But again, at the same time, they're really good learning moments, because you're like, you just have to keep calm and carry on. Do you know what I mean? Because otherwise you'll be stuck in that same space, feeling resentful, getting a chip on your shoulder, all this sort of stuff that you see a lot of, you know, people say a lot of the time, oh yeah, that person is jaded. And a lot of the time it's because they're probably stuck in a space of rejection, of feeling like, God, man, screw these people because they hurt me back, you know, 20 years ago.
Yeah. And I suppose there's a way of harnessing that energy in a different way. And we'll come on to that, because you've talked about your dad and how you've used that more recently with your work in game development. Can you just, while we're on the acting thing, can you remember what your your first role was. We had Melisante Mahu on the podcast.
No way!
From also performing in Assassin's Creed. Yeah, amazing. Yeah. Also, her face is following me everywhere because you're doing this TV show on the BBC at the moment about Egypt. And every time I log on to the website, her face is just staring at me all of the time.
Dude, she is like, she's not only is she so good, but she's literally everywhere. Like, I remember...
You can't move her.
Like, you can't, no, really. I remember seeing her in, after... Obviously, she came into sort of light in sort of my periphery of Assassin's Creed.
Yeah.
And, you know, ever since then, funnily enough, I've just seen her in like TV, film, like everywhere. And it's great to see because she is so good. She is incredibly talented.
And if you want to listen to it, you can go back and you can find our interview with Melisante on the podcast on Spotify and all the places, Apple and on YouTube and everything. But her first role, she told us when she was on the pod, was as a donkey. In a production. So can you remember what your first ever acting job was?
I can. And you know what was so great? This was like, I remember how much did I got paid like 700 quid for this, and I was like, what?
Wow, hello, like, made it.
Mate, honestly, making it rain. I was like, what? I think I was either 15 or 16.
That is so much cash when you're 15. Bro, oh my goodness.
It was nuts. And keep in mind, like, again, coming from like a very kind of working class sort of background, didn't get any pocket money, like no pocket money. Like chores were just a given. Like you do it.
You don't get money. Get on with it.
But I did this, I got this job through like, again, I think it was through NYT and through like the first sort of agent, whatever. And it was this ITV gig. Was it ITV? I think it was ITV. It was either ITV or something, but it was called The Jury. And I was playing like this, I think it was like the Senegalese, like older brother to one of the main characters of the show who was definitely older than me.
I love that. He's got a beard, lads. Is that a problem?
Honestly. And like when I read the script, so the script originally, so first of all, my audition went terribly because I went to the audition room and I'm good friends now with the casting directors, but I went to the audition room and they were like, right, are you ready? And I'm like, yeah. And they're like, go on. I was like, oh no, I don't know what. They're like, you didn't get the sides. And I obviously had the sides, but I didn't check. I just didn't know. And so I was like, no. So they gave me the sides. They got me outside there, just read it and then come back in. And I did it and I read it and I got it. And I don't know why. I don't know how that happened.
Anyway, you're not in control. You're not driving the bus.
Again, this is it, right? So I got this gig and it was filmed all the way, you know, sort of at the time I was in Welling Garden and this was out in sort of London somewhere outside of London, can't remember. It was a way away, but I remember just getting on the train and been thinking to myself, oh, this is how I die. But like
it's over.
But this gig, man, this job was so funny because when I read the script, originally it was supposed to be like it's set in America and I'm like, you know, I've immigrated to America and I've got like family around and I'm on the cooking, you know, cooking at the barbecue and you know, then I'm talking to my brother on the phone and I'm talking to him, you know, in English saying, don't worry about it, mate, you can come here, you can come, like it's all fine in like this faux American-y accent. Anyway, comes to the day and the director was like, okay, we're gonna film it in nighttime. And I was like, okay. You're in an apartment and you're sleeping next to your wife. And I'm like 15 and I'm like thinking, sleeping next to my wife? What's that? Is this allowed? And then the craziest bit was he was like, yeah, so you're going to be reading this all in Senegalese. And I was like,
just drop that in. Literally, yeah, sure.
Bro, on the day. And fine. I was like, what do you mean? Like, and he's like, we've got this guy from, you know, from Senegal who's going to come and he's going to teach you essentially the lines. You're going to just parrot what he says. And then on the day, you're just going to do it. Just say whatever you got it. And I was, and mate, again, I'm 15 and I've been told, like, I've just learned these lines in English. And now I've been told to learn it in like Senegalese on this phone, like next to, you know, a very lovely, lovely lady who was an SA. She was a supporting artist. Yeah. And this was back in the day as well, where they didn't really treat essays nicely. So they were so the director would just be like, all right, can you get off the bed? And she just without saying a word, just left. And I was like, didn't even ask like politely. Like, it was so wild. So that was, That was my first gig. Oh, but also on top of that, I was just in my boxers.
And you're 15.
You couldn't do that today,
you,
man.
You wouldn't. I mean,
you couldn't do that.
Without
today.
Sounding old, like you wouldn't like that. Is just there are rules now for a
I'm
reason.
Telling you,
there are rules for a reason. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, yeah, so that was my
baptism was more
fire.
Stressful. That or being the goat. To be fair, I don't know. I don't know what's going.
Honestly.
So you're starting to get your jobs. You're getting your 700. I mean, to be fair, though, 700 quid when you're 15.
I know that was honestly. I remember that hitting like my bank account and just being like, oh wow, this is.
Yeah.
I'm not gonna spend a penny. I just want to look at it.
Haribo's it on me, absolutely.
Yeah.
And then when did you start to think that actually performing in games was going to be a thing? Because I suppose because you've written before,
yeah.
You've spoken about your love of games grew with your dad, didn't it? And that's when you always played games growing up, right? So I don't like the term gamer. We've talked about this before, ooh. Actually, but just for shorthand, were you a sort of quote unquote gamer growing up, and that was because of your
yeah,
dad, right?
And like you know, it was my main form of sort of entertainment. Put it that way, yeah. I think in the same way, like. You know, people had film, they had TV, they had books. Mine was games. And I think, you know, one of the things that I am so thankful for my dad for was at that time, there was a lot of stigma, right, towards games. The idea of it being a waste of time, the idea of it, you know, making you violent. And actually my dad kind of saw past that, didn't really necessarily see that as a thing. And
yeah,
so it was like, nah, this is good fun, like enjoy it. So yeah, so games were definitely my way of kind of passing time, enjoying myself, taking in stories as I was growing up. And funnily enough, I didn't really know you could have a career in games until I started, you know, doing voiceover when I did Assassin's Creed, essentially. Like it just wasn't in my periphery. Like it was, I knew I loved games, I knew I loved playing them, but the idea of being in them almost felt like so far away. It was almost like a dream in a weird way. And it was only until I did Assassin's Creed and started learning like, oh no, there's an actual career here. There's an actual life here where it started to make sense. And it started to kind of paint this picture in my mind of like, yeah, this is what I want to do. This is something that I really, really enjoy, that I have fun doing, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, and what a role to do it, going straight in with a big one like that. Can you remember what games did you play with your dad when you introduced it to games?
Oh, man, Golden Axe, Sonic.
Oh, yes.
You know, Legend of Zelda, Ninja Gaiden, you know, the Shinobi. Like, dude, like Tekken 2, the old, you know, classic Tomb Raider. Like, a lot. There was a lot. You know, we went through, and the good thing about my dad was like, again, I never really asked for much apart from like if you know, and this was back in Blockbuster time, right?
Yeah.
So,
yeah,
you know, where you could literally just go out, rent a game,
amazing times,
play it,
amazing,
bring it back in, you know what I mean? And I do remember I'm sure I've done this as well, like in the past, where I was so obsessed and in love with games that there would be times where I'd literally just blitz a game out and probably have enough time to sort of return it, you know, yeah. Because it was like, we knew, like my dad was like, listen, man, you ain't got time for this game.
Whole
game. We don't got the money for it.
Yeah, yeah.
Return it or you ain't eating. So yeah, but those were the beginnings of a GoldenEye was a big, you know, we played again together on the 64 as well. Like we played a lot, man, which was really cool, which was really good fun.
Yeah, that's a summer head. I mean, that's a heck of a back catalogue, because often people sort of in introduction to it are sort of more of your blockbuster titles back in the day.
Yeah. Right?
Games like Golden, I mean, Golden Axe, I suppose, was a blockbuster at the time, which we don't think about it. Do you think that we look at those sort of blockbuster eras? I used to remember going to hire Aaron Bergerin. What was the Athens or Sydney Olympic, like the game, and you could sprint and you could cheat using the pen?
Yeah.
I remember hiring that from our local, like, video shop or whatever. Do you think sometimes we are we guilty of being like, oh yeah, they were better days. They were much better than the sort of digital download stuff that we do now with rose-tinted glasses. But there was something like so communal about it, wasn't it?
Yeah, there was. And I think, but I do think that there was, it was just a different time, like before the whole internet blew up and online play. Like I remember, you know, sort of just, it's just a different time. Like I feel like we're at the, it's a bit like the way that Netflix has sort of changed the way that people watch TV and watch content and take in content. Like, you know, we're in a place now where we are, as a consumer, a lot more in control. Like as an audience, we are a lot more in control as to what we get, what we're given, and what we want to do. Whereas back then it was kind of like, yeah, like you had to, you know, GoldenEye was the only kind of shooter that you could really play, or you know, or even like a bit of Doom or Quake or whatever. Like it was, you had to select. Whereas now I can literally, you know, come on here, play Ball X Pit, jump on my Xbox, play Cyberpunk, you know, turn on my PlayStation 5 and go on their whole PS Plus catalog. Like there's just so much more at our fingertips. Whereas back then, yeah, you're right, there was like almost like a, because it was limited, it almost felt quite special. But I'd say though, you know, that's just the way, you know, sort of things move. Like even when I look back at like film and TV specific, you know, especially like I never used to watch TV. Now I probably watch more TV than I do film, because of the quality of content that's kind of been produced out there.
Yeah. You know? Sometimes I struggle with choice anxiety.
Yeah.
Because there's so much. I'm like, well, okay, I'm gonna invest my, you know, time is scarce. I've got two very small children. Yeah. And we've moved house, all this stuff. Time is scarce. Right. I've got an hour. What am I gonna do? Am I gonna play this? Am I gonna play that? Which console am I gonna play it on? Oh wait, I could watch this, I could watch that, I could start. You know what I mean? By the time I've made a choice, the hour's gone and I've got to go to bed.
Literally, honestly, it's gone. It is, and that's, I'm finding that a lot, especially with a kid. Like you end up just essentially spending more time trying to pick something and then watching it for like half an hour and then being like, you know what? I'm just gonna go to bed. it's a lot, man. It is a lot. The only time you can enjoy watching something is if you're traveling. Like I find like I get a lot of my back like catalog of stuff done when I'm on a plane or like I am on a train or, you know, traveling for a day in like, be it like Manchester or whatever. Like I can just be like, right, I'm just going to focus on this and watch this and do that. You know?
Yeah, I'm working away this week and I've just finished the Witcher TV show finally, which is like, great, good. I'm getting it done. I'm getting stuff done.
What do you think?
So I thought the casting of Emir the Vampire was tip top. Right. He's my favorite character in the books. He's brilliant in the games. So I loved that. I give it like a 7 out of 10.
Yeah, I agree. I think there is, I don't know, man. Just sort of like,
did you notice a difference between the casting of the lead? Did you notice the change between Cavill and Liam Hemsworth?
Yeah, to a degree. I think, I mean, like, look, again, they all give their own different salt. Personally, I actually preferred Hemsworth, weirdly. I think, again, not to shade on Cavill, I think Cavill's great and I think he's brilliant, but I do think there is a lot of love for the man because of who he is rather than necessarily for what he does. And I'm not, again, shading on his performance. I think his performance was great, but there was something about Hemsworth which I felt like I could connect more, weirdly, and I could also lose myself more to him playing The Witcher, whereas when I'm watching Cavill, I'm like, oh, it's Cavill playing The Witcher. Oh, it's Cavill being sued. You know what I mean? Like, it's very...
Is that hard for an actor? Because it's interesting, because like, obviously, so Lawrence Fishburne, who plays Regis in it, and I think he's, like I said, perfect casting. I think he does it really well. But I am aware, I suppose, that it is Lawrence Fishburne. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Even though I'm enjoying the performance, I'm aware, I suppose, the same as Cavill, like, you are aware that it's him.
Yeah. And I think, like, look, like, I genuinely... I think the bigger your name... the harder it is to essentially escape who you are as a like people looking at you for who you are than essentially the character you're playing. The only way you can do that is, you know, with an incredibly cracking team on every single sector. So for hair and makeup, they make you, you know, the transform elements that make you look, you know, or feel different. The writing has to be completely on point, like in every scene, the direction, the editing, the scene, like there is so much that has to be at play to almost make you to transform you in a way. And I think like a good example, I would say, of this is if you look at who's the brilliant actor who passed away a while back. He was.
Can you narrow it down for me?
He was funnily enough in Hunger Games. He was in The Master. It was oh god, the name is escaping.
It's gonna come in. It happens. Like, mate, you got a child. I mean, that doesn't make a difference.
God, don't even. But it's anyway, gonna come. But you will. Okay, let me try and think of another.
Philip Seymour Hoffman.
Boom, that's the one. So like, you know, he is. Whenever you see this guy perform, not only is he an incredible, incredible, incredible performer, but he transforms in everything that he does. And I think like that's, you know, that is again very lucky in regards to having a great and a fantastic team around him that allow him to sort of escape himself in that regard.
Yeah.
I mean, even there we go. There Will Be Blood. Daniel Day-Lewis. So like, you know, even with someone like him who, again, incredible performer, but he just has a team around him that really is really good at transforming him and making him look different. I think actually, in fact, when you look at even The Rock, Dwayne Johnson, in the recent film that he's just done, which apparently is considered a flop at the box office. Again, what was great is actually he transformed himself and he was different. I wasn't watching The Rock. I was actually watching an actor here perform a character. And I think like that's what I mean by like, there are so many different other elements and factors that needs to come at play, especially with how big your name is, in order to convince an audience that you are the character. So then when I was watching The Witcher, it's watching Hemsworth, who I've seen, you know, in a few things here and there. I haven't really, don't really know much of him. I'm able to believe his fantasy more than I am with Cavill, who I have seen in quite a lot of stuff, like Superman, like that Greek mythological film that he was in, you know, and that's just it, you know.
I suppose where that is less of a problem is when you're working in games, right? Because you can get totally transformed into something else. And do you then have to approach it differently when you're performing in a game and you know doing mocap or whatever, as opposed to when you're on the set of a TV show?
I think the thing a lot of the time you just have to take into consideration is, I always say it's the music of the voice that is a lot more important there. You're having to convey more through your voice and through that, more so than your eyes, your body, your ears, whatever. Like, I think, yes, okay, you also have to listen to the other party, but a lot of the time you're recording lines just by themselves, and like you're gonna have, or you're listening to someone else who's recorded it, and you're playing off that. So it's like, I feel like it's very much with games about the music of the voice. When it comes to motion capture and everything, obviously you can have fun and play with it. But again, your performance a lot of the time is going to be edited by the animator, you know, to make it make sense to, you know, by the way it's cut. Like, I think like the only thing you really do truly have control of as an actor in games is your voice. And I think that's why it is so important to sort of enjoy in that and kind of live in that, and why there's a lot of problems now and talk about the whole AI shtick. Like, it is because that's the only thing you do have control of.
Yeah. Where do you sit then on the AI stuff? It's gonna have to come up, obviously, because it's such a big talking point at the moment, and it's obviously something that concerns a lot of people.
Yeah.
People saying, you know, it's you know, you could use it creatively. What's your take on it?
So look, the thing is that I kind of see it. So as an artist, I'm not afraid of it, because I feel like as human beings, we can just tell when something's real and when something isn't. And, you know, I feel as well, like there is so much soul in everything that we do as artists that you can kind of, like, it's just innate in us. Like, there is something that connects us to what another human, like, we always want what another human does. We don't want necessarily something that's kind of you know, generated and without any soul. And yeah. I think, like, you know, yes, okay, I can totally, as a developer and as, you know, as a producer or whatever, like, I can totally understand, like, the cost efficiency of it, but, or I can understand the sense of the, well, say, cost efficiency. It actually costs so much to use AI anyway as a whole, if you really look into it. But, like, I think as a tool, as a way of kind of speeding up elements of processes or stuff, like, it can be beneficial. But I just think that there is a danger of relying too much on it to essentially be as a replacement, which I think is the wrong way of looking at it. You know, I don't think that there's nothing good of relying on something that is completely automated to replace something. So, you know, I think the best way I can always think about it is, like, when I'm on the phone asking for help on something and I'm put to an automated machine, I'm more pissed off than anything. Yeah. You know what I mean? It's like,
don't get me started on the tech admin of the world.
Bro, I don't want that. I want someone human. And I think, like, that is essentially my answer to it all. Like, I get that it's a way of expediting, like, a process or maybe kind of funneling you to the right people. Totally cool. As long as you get me to a human being at the end of it, I'm down for that. But if you're going to use it as a replacement, we got problems.
Yeah. If AI doesn't take over the world and you lose all your jobs, are you hoping to do more game performance? I know you've got a really interesting mixed career at the moment of, like, stuff we're doing in games, but also we'll in House of Dragon and I'm a big Game of Thrones fan, so I'm watching. I'm very excited for the new series and trying to guess who's what. But you know, are you still enjoying performing in games as much?
Yeah,
as you can,
man.
Tell?
I honestly love it. Like, I do love it, and I think, like, it's so annoying because I want to do more motion capture. I want to do more game stuff. Like, I do, but for some reason, and again, I'm not complaining, I just feel like there has been a lot more opportunity for me in TV and film, even though that there are so many games out there. And, like, I think, like, I don't know, it was, I have had one of those weird careers where, or interesting careers, let's say, where, you know, my first video game was Assassin's Creed Origins. And, like, you know, it was huge, right? And but maybe people think I'm, like, stupidly expensive. It's like, because
you should see his day rate, lads. My goodness.
Whereas I'm like, buddy, I'm a UK
actor. I'm cheap, lads.
I'm like, I want to do this.
Yeah, I'm
affordable. To do this, like, literally. So, yeah, so it's been a funny one, man. Like, I do want to do more games. And look, I've got some things cooking anyway at the moment, but, like, it's really funny. Like, I did Assassin's Creed, and then it's like, I've had drips and drabs here and there, but it did really go cold. So I was just like, well, I'll just go back to filming TV then. Or what I'll do is I'll make a game and cast myself in it.
Yeah, yeah. You've got the power. You've got the power to do that. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I don't get it. Who's playing the lead title? Who do you think's playing
the lead
title?
Oh, who do you think is playing? Yeah. Exactly. Yeah,
it's me. Yeah. Thank you very much.
I'll do it for free.
I just noted, though, that none of your games have included any characters from Wales.
Oh, okay. As of yet. No. Okay. Well, I will
just note it.
Okay. I will just, you know, I'll keep
just
that
write
in mind.
That down.
I will. I'll write it down. I'll tell
broadcast
the team.
Voice.
I had
an A-level drama.
Sure. Oh, really? Oh, okay.
I've tread the boards.
Okay.
You know?
I'll keep. You know what? I will definitely
just.
I'll call you on that. I'll call you on that, and we'll
see. This is recorded. This is going out on the internet, so people can remember that. It's very good.
Right. You know what's really funny though? Like, I'm the worst person to tell that kind of stuff to, because I'll be like, cool, I'll make you something, and we'll do it. And then we'll go.
Oh, he's actually calling me. Is he okay? Okay, fine. Yeah, why not? Yeah, I can do that.
All right.
Before we transition on into you as a game developer and as a game creator, we started off with your first role. What was your dream role? If someone, you know, if you could choose anything, whether it's a game or a film or a whatever, if someone could say, you can be anyone you want to be. Who would it be? Like, so for me, if there was, I tell you what, we're redoing Lord of the Rings and we need an Aragorn with a Southwest Whalian accent and who wears glasses. And we're like, you know what? That's me. I could do Aragorn.
Oh, you know. I'd say Spawn is probably a
Oh, is
really,
it?
Yeah, I'd say Spawn. I'd say it's between Spawn and Blade.
So were you a comic book guy growing up then?
Yeah, man. Yeah, I used to read a lot of comics. Read a lot of manga as well.
Yeah.
You know, watched a lot of cartoons and anime. Yeah, I'd say Spawn. Spawn was one of those characters as well where I think because it weirdly creeped me out as a kid, I enjoyed it. It's funny. I like look at my daughter has it does maybe it's a kid thing, but my daughter does the same thing. She's three, and I showed her the other day The Nightmare Before Christmas. And as I was watching this, I was like, man, this is actually quite.
Yeah, this is fine.
This is a lot. Intense. You know what I mean? Like, he's saying like he's going to eat Santa and all sorts of stuff. Anyway, she's obsessed now with Nightmare Before Christmas. Like, obsessed to the point where I'm even like, okay, that's a bit creepy.
But
that was me, man. That was like, I remember there was a really dark comic that I was able to kind of get my hands on. Because I think like a cousin had bought it, was given it, and it was Batman, but he was like the Man Bat, where he was an actual bat.
Okay.
It was a really dark and gruesome comic.
Yeah,
and I remember reading this as a kid and just being obsessed with this, and like so yeah, but again terrified me. So like it's like I think like yeah, Spawn was one of those ones where it was. As a story, as a world, as a universe, or as a character anyway, it was something that I would love to take a stab at, I think.
Well, look, we've put it out into the ether now.
You know,
you've manifested it. When it happens, then I'll take 12%.
We'll come back here. Okay, cool. Yeah, you'll take 12. Okay, great.
Oh, he's happy with 12.
okay, it's all true. Sure thing.
But yeah, then obviously come back and tell us about it as well.
Right.
So you're performing in games, you're doing well in telly and film as well, and then you have a thought to yourself, you know what? Why don't I just make some games as well? Where does that come from? You know, and to have the confidence and then think, yeah, I can go and do this.
I don't know whether it's okay. It's either confidence or ignorance.
Just naivety. Yeah, totally naivety.
Pure naivety. It was during season one or two of Raised by Wolves. It was during its period of time where COVID hit, and I decided that because if someone like Ridley Scott can say yes to me and be like, you know, you've got the chops, I'm going to give you a decent role in this show. If someone like him sees talent, then I should start believing in myself a bit more and tell my own stories. And so it was weirdly a moment in time where I always wanted to explore the grief that I had felt after losing my father and depict it in a way that felt truthful to me and truthful to the experiences that I remember talking to people about with this stuff. And I'd written like a pitch for a TV show. I'd, you know, tried a film. I'd even written like, you know, short films, whatever, but none of it really kind of stuck. And it was only until I started playing Ori and it was The Blind Forest at the time.
Yeah.
Where it just sort of clicked. And I was like, no, it needs to be a game. It needs to be something that I shared a lot with my father. I did a lot with my father. It needs to be honest on that front. That's how I can honestly tell the story. So it has to be a game. And honestly, man, like if it wasn't for the fact that it was this sort of, it was like the fuel. That was like the fuel and engine and drive to making this was telling the story about my dad and knowing that it had to be a game. If it wasn't for that, I don't know how the hell I would have survived making a game because it is ruthless. making film and TV and even theater is like 100 times easier than making a game. Like it's
Why is it? Is it because of the technical requirements of it? Is it to take? Because also, if you're exploring grief in a game, that's when you're exploring grief anyway. Well, however you want to do it, that's hard, right? Because you've got to sit with that emotion for a time, and the the gestation period of making game is longer. So you're having to stick with it for even longer as well.
Right? Yeah. Yeah. And it's like, I think there's that. There's also the aspect, as you say, like the technical elements of it, finding a team of people that you're having to, you know, talk and gel well and trying to kind of, you know, convey the vision and idea of it as a whole. I think the fact that you can literally make anything and do anything in games, like anything, is what is so, you know, you get given money to make an experience and you can do anything. Like there is like, you know, with film and TV, the script is already done. The, you know, there is limitations obviously of the physical material world of you're not going to have stupid amounts of money to kind of do VFX like crazy, because that just doesn't make sense. But in games, because it is technically this art form that is so limitless, that is bound, you know, it's boundless. There's no boundaries here. It's quite daunting.
Yeah.
So it's like trying to, and again, the first time trying to make a game like that and trying to distill it into this experience, it was a lot. And I think, like, you know, one of the things is that I've always sort of said to myself was like, I've got to find that formula of how do we make games fast, slick, and quick, because the idea of, like, you know, Zao took us 3.5 years to make. Like it was a beast. And that was, you know, a lot of the time was really essentially finding the team, building the team and building them up and trying to work that way up. But then also it was finding what was fun about this game and where it was. Like I had a vision and idea of it, but truly, like, to then put that on pads and on sticks and convey that was, it's a lot, man. It's hard.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
There are all these different aspects and elements that you have to think of when it comes to making video games that I think a lot of the time people don't necessarily, you know, they don't think of, right?
And especially because your vision for that, I mean, when you're talking, when you tell people what the sort of the purpose of the game is and what you're trying to convey, and then also it's a 2D adventure side-scrolling game. Mm. Sometimes that takes a little bit of like getting people to meet in the middle there, isn't
yeah,
it? Did you have to spend, look, I know it looks and feels like this, but I wanted to tell this story. They are two different things. That must have been tough.
I mean, like the thing is I think marrying elements like that, as long as you know what you're trying to convey and what you're trying to do, like I always said with Zao, like I wanted it to feel fun, fast-paced, you know, feel vibrant, have the colors pop, because again, culturally, you know, that is Bantu, that is Africa, you know, the colors are popping. There is, you know, death and grief isn't necessarily seen as something sad, it's loud. And I think like that's what I wanted to convey. So there was, you know, and also the fun, you know, franticness was really kind of reflective of my sort of remembrance of playing games with my father. So, like, you know, they were always kind of crazy fun and, you know, and what they were. They were never like, you know, Hellblade. Like, you know what I mean? Like, it wasn't like that. So I think, like, it was, you know, trying to kind of, there was always an element of vision to convey that. I think it's then about, you know, trying to capture exactly what that is technically and on the gameplay feel, which I think is most of the battle. You know, obviously bugs and optimization and all that kind of stuff as well, like, comes into account. Then, like, kind of getting them onto working on different consoles is another battle as a whole. But, like, ultimately, like, it is, you know, if the vision is strong, a lot of the time it is everything else that is incredibly tricky. If the vision if the vision isn't strong, that's where I think a lot of video games die. You know what I mean? Like,
you can feel a game. I've always thought you can feel a game that's been made by accountants or on a spreadsheet. It's like, oh, well, this game is doing, these sorts of games are doing well at the moment. Mm. So let's make one of these. I often think of grief or the grieving as a process rather than an event, if you know what I mean. So have you found, since making the game, and of course it did so well and it won the BAFTA, and it's been a few years now since it's been released, have you, not that you ever move on from it, but has it helped you deal with that grief and sort of and put it in a place where you can sort of manage it? Or actually did it open things up more, because you are faced with it more often, because we're talking about it again now and you'll see people playing it and things.
Yeah, I think it's a funny one, man, because like, I didn't really know what to expect from making Zao and sort of throwing it into the world. But I also didn't expect it to have this sort of weird, emotional, impactful effect that it has had on me. Both like, you know, on a sort of in a positive way, but also in a weird negative way. And what I mean by that is, like, I think, so we talk about rejection, right? And we spoke about that earlier and about, like, you know, a lot of the time I can kind of deal with, you know, someone saying no to me now. And I can kind of deal with someone sort of being like, ah, didn't really like him in that show. I can a lot of the time just put it down to like, ah, well, you know, it was a writing. Or like, you know, I wasn't really feeling it. Whereas with Zhao, because it was so personal, it kind of took me by surprise how much it, like, it really, like, meant to me, where I was reading and hearing everything under the sun of this game. Like, I was watching videos, I was reading all the reviews, I was reading all the comments, and like, and it really felt personal. And I think, like, in a weird way, the grief aspect of it didn't necessarily come into play. I think, like, it revealed another side to me that almost made me realize, oh no, I do really care. I do have a bit of an ego, in the sense of, like, it can be bruised. Like, you know what I mean? Like, I think that's what it did. But I think it was because it was such a personal game.
Yeah.
And it was about my journey and my experience. It felt like everything was kind of related or resonated to that, you know? Even, you know, things like, for example, oh, the game keeps crashing, it's terrible. It's like, that has nothing to do with me, like, or grief, you know what I mean? It's just a technical element that we could fix, but I still felt moved by that. So I think that's what it did. I think it revealed another side to me that I felt like I needed to just sort of, I had not necessarily thought of or needed to wrestle with. And I wrestled with it, and I'm wrestling with it now. I think I'm very much like you in regards to, I see grief very much as a process, and like, it's something that I know will never leave me. It will always be with me. Like, you know, my dad passed away, as I say, like, what, like 13 years ago. And, you know, I had my daughter, you know, 10 years after she passed, and I was kind of all right with my dad's, you know, not all right, but I was kind of, you know.
Yeah, you're coping with it, yeah.
As soon as my daughter came, you know, into life, everything came back, and it was like, and it was on a different shade, you know what I mean? And I think, like, that's what I think about grief. It's like, it will always kind of waves and hit me, you know, wherever, whenever. Like, I think, like, that's the thing about it. So in a way, I was kind of, I knew that making Zhao wasn't going to necessarily heal that grief or make me see it in a different light. I just didn't expect making Zhao and releasing Zhao to almost reveal another side to me personally that I was like, oh man, I have to deal with this.
And you obviously using your games to talk about, to tackle, or to explore things that are important to you. Because then Dead Take, which came out recently, is doing the same thing in a, you know, totally different, you know, totally different experience completely. And it's sort of about your profession, I suppose, and sort of quite satirical in that way.
Yeah.
What made you think, I fancy taking a poking fun at my own my own industry
here? So Dead Take was really I think after Zhao, after making Zhao and kind of putting Zhao out there, and then after going through the industry sort of almost imploding in on itself, I think, you know, because this is the thing, like, once we made Zhao, we were kind of told or sort of directed by the industry to make a bigger game. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, go big, go, like, more money, throw stupid money at this thing. And we went down that route. But the issue with something like that, obviously, when the industry is imploding, is that no one's going to, you know, it just doesn't make any sense. It doesn't make any sense. And so what happened was, I think I got very tired of the way in which, you know, sort of a lot of these kind of accountants and the way that the you know, the industry is run by a lot of money people.
Yeah.
And sort of I got tired by them telling me what I should and shouldn't do, and was just like, I'm just going to do what I want. And I feel like this was right at the time as well, where, like, I think we're seeing it even now, like, where indie games and indie kind of publishers and indie developers are beginning to take control. Like, you know, they're beginning to essentially have a lot more say as to kind of what they want to do. You look at things like Peak, you look at, like, you know, Powell World, you look at, like, even, you know, Dispatch, for example. These independent drivers were like, ah, screw it, we're going to do it our way. I think I kind of was like, yeah, I just want to do my own thing. And I want to kind of take the mick out of you know, the darkness that resides within my industry as a whole that everyone knows of, but also kind of poke, you know, kind of make this game that that shouldn't necessarily be made, an FMV Hollywood game with, you know, big names attached to it, that is, you know, that that we can do. And I think I remember pitching it to Bucky, who's the, you know, the sort of the head of publishing over at Pocket Pair. And this was before they had started looking into publishing. And I pitched him two games. I pitched him like this big kind of, you know, crazy, you know, multi-million sort of dollar game idea. And he was like, oh, it's a bit too big. It's, I don't know if that's it. And I was like, all right, well, how about we make this really cool sort of stupid, like, you to Hollywood game where it's like I get Ben Starr, Neil and Jane and all these kind of cool, you know, hot actors at the moment and do an FMV horror game. And Bucky was like, okay. And I was like, and it's like, how long would it take? And I was like, we could do it in like, I don't know, 6-7 months. And he was like, sure. And so then, yeah, and that's kind of how it kind of all came about. It was almost like a purge in a way. It was like a sense of like showing like, yeah, no, we can make cool, fun games that aren't necessarily directly related and still have fun with it, you know?
Yeah. And I suppose it was interesting timing because it sort of came off the back of all the performers in games doing that piece in Entertainment Weekly, wasn't it? Was it Entertainment Weekly? Yeah. And sort of turning the attention on performers in video games and sort of the role that, you know, because often people, and I've done it loads in the past in my old job, I would do interviews with Hollywood actors when they suddenly decided they wanted to be in games, and people would take pay more attention to games if you've got a quote unquote Hollywood A-lister in there. Mm-hmm. And I suppose, are you noticing now that there's a bit of a change in that? Are you seeing more performers wanting to get into games and asking you for advice on that side?
I'd say there's definitely more. There's more of an appetite for it. I think that there is, there's still this sort of fear. Because I think like that there is this enjoyment of like the idea of like, yeah, I want to be in games. I want to do games. I want to like kind of get into games. And then they kind of see as well, like the toxicity is also very, very open about, you know, when it comes to the games industry. So then when people see that, I think like there is this kind of aversion to it as well of like, I don't need that in my life. Like, yeah. I think like there is this feeling of, again, because look, don't get me wrong. I think it's, The beauty of games is that it's as an industry as a whole, and also just as a community, we're very open and we kind of share what we feel because we care. There's a lot of care for this stuff. But I think that with that also comes this kind of element of sharing maybe too much. And so it's quite frightening. And I think like because it is so open and like the fact that I can just come into this industry and make a game and kind of make games, like, that doesn't really happen in film and TV. Like film and TV is kind of, you've got to go through quite a lot of barriers. Whereas there's definitely a low barrier of entry here. I think like there is that. So the allure and the idea of being in games is very, very exciting and enticing. But I actually think that there is also still this fear of like, oh, but am I really ready to face that level of criticism?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, listen, mate, it's been an absolute joy having you with us. There's a couple of questions just to finish up. Sort of following on from that, we had a big chat on our podcast a couple of weeks ago because I was listening to another podcast that I'm a big fan of, and they were sort of depicting what their image of what like a quote-unquote, again, the phrase gamer is. And it was so outdated, it took me a bit by surprise because someone who sort of lives and breathes and makes this podcast and has reported on games for a long time and whatever. My picture of what people who play games are is totally different to what was presented to me on like one of my favorite podcasts. I'm like, oh wow, actually there is still a stigma or misinterpretation of what people who play games is. Well, as someone who works in the industry, who performs them, who makes them, but also has got a foot in the most glamorous side of global culture as well, in Hollywood and Game of Thrones and what have you. Do you think the industry has moved past, or people who play games are still attached to a stigma, or have we actually moved past it?
I think we've definitely moved past it. I still feel like there's still steps to be taken to sort of break that stigma. I feel like because of the fact that a lot of the, you know, the younger generation who used to play games are now kind of working. Like, we are the voices of today, right? Yeah, yeah. I think, like, naturally, that then, you know, it becomes normal. It becomes the idea, you know, games become normal. It becomes an idea of, like, you know, we're all technically gamers. You got a game on your phone. Solitaire, you see, is a game. It's not a card game. It's a game, right? You're playing games. Everyone plays games. So I think that's definitely breaking. But I do feel like we are still, you know, a ways away to sort of being seen as an art form. I think, like, that's it, right? I think, like, the thing about film, TV, theater, going to a gallery, they're all seen as art. And, you know, it's still quite hard to kind of convey to, you know, anyone and everyone that games are an art. And I strongly do believe that they are. It's just trying to convince, you know, someone like my mum that, you know, playing as a mountain climber is, you know, trying to climb this thing where I can eat my friends sometimes is also art. you know what I mean? Yeah. It's like, but yeah, I think we're getting there. I think we've still got a ways away, but I think we're getting there.
Yeah, it caught me a bit by surprise. It's like, oh, I thought we were kind of past these conversations. And actually, I've been having this back and forth in my mind as to whether or not it's important or not, what other people think of how I like spending my spare time but
I think you know, a lot of people are accepting,
do you know what I mean?
Yeah, they're more accepting of it, because I think the thing is, it's like you have to explain. I think that's the thing, that's the issue.
Yeah,
it's like, that's the frustrating bit. It's like, if I told someone, yeah, I really enjoy films, they're like, oh, you're a cinephile, ooh, artsy, ooh, or whatever, right?
Yeah.
Or like, I enjoy reading books. It's like, I do see that in the same vein of like, yeah, I enjoy, you know, playing games. I think, like, that's fine. That, like, again, it's another way of kind of entertainment. But people, I think, especially people who don't really play games a lot, the first thing they think of is like either Call of Duty, FIFA, or Grand Theft Auto.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Or like, oh, like Minecraft, or like, you know, Fortnite. Like,
yeah,
these are games that, like, are just, it's very different to essentially, you know, the actual games. Like, again, like, I'm not saying that those aren't games, but I'm just saying, like, it's like different to like a game that when I tell my friends, yeah, I'm playing this game at the moment called like Unpacking, for example, they're like, what the hell is that? And then you go into it and you're like, oh, wow. Oh, that's interesting. That's really cool. You know what I mean? So you have to explain more, I think. Whereas if I just say like, yeah, I enjoy watching movies in my spare time, there's almost like a sense of like, oh, so educated.
Yeah. I've seen all of his previous films as well, actually. Thank you very much. Well, listen, Abu, thank you very much for coming on to Press X. It's been a joy having you with us. I know we've fans of House of the Dragon here will have seen the little teaser that's dropped and you wielding a sword and that, which is very exciting. What else have you got coming up that people can get excited about? Man,
there's a few things, but I can't talk about them.
Nah,
it's one of those ones where, again, very fortunate to be working.
Yeah, I know.
But I genuinely can't say anything, which is really annoying. But yeah,
I found that because I've, you know, worked in news most of my career, so I could, you know, if something was in here, it was coming out of there pretty much immediately. And then I started doing this TV show about Doctor Who, which obviously we filmed, you know, a year or so in advance before they hit the TV screens. And I found it so weird having to have secrets.
Yeah.
And I'd be like, oh yeah, so what happens? Well, I know, I just can't tell you.
I
found
anything.
That it's so weird and so hard.
It's
practice, because you've got it's all of your projects are like in here and they do not under any circumstances come out there.
Yeah.
Well, listen, whatever they are, good luck, all the best, and
thank you.
And we'll have to chat again soon. Thank you very much, mate.
Definitely. Thank you, man.